You can be old and not be wise, but you can't be wise if you're not this old. Not this much, this long, this often, not as a habit. The gift comes late, perhaps as compensation.
Good morning and welcome to Jonesy, the show that brings you conversations with some of the most interesting people in the world of books, podcasts, radio, theater, music, food, and humor, guaranteed to entertain and enlighten. I'm the host of Jonesy, Ken Jones. No relation, by the way. My friend and KBOO colleague Judith Arcana passed away in December at the age of 82. Judith was a poet, writer, teacher, radio host, and activist. Her work includes a biography of Grace Paley titled Grace Paley's Life Stories, the poetry collections What If Your Mother, Fourth Period English, The Parachute Jump Effect, Announcements from the Planetarium, and Here from Somewhere Else, and the story collection Hello, This is Jane. A longtime teacher of literature, writing, and women's studies, Judith also volunteered as a Jane, a member of the Chicago Underground Service that helped more than 11,000 women get safe, illegal abortions before the U.S. Supreme Court ruled on Roe v. Wade in January 1973. KBOO listeners might know Judith from her monthly poetry show, Poetry and Everything, which aired from July 2016 through March 2020. I interviewed Judith several times over the years and always enjoyed talking with her both on and off the mic. She was a woman of great kindness, humanity, and wisdom. On today's show, we'll be celebrating her life and work with a sampling of our conversations on her poetry, her book on Grace Paley, and her writings about her life as a Jane in pre-Roe v. Wade Chicago. First up is an interview for KBOO's Between the Covers in July 2017 on her poetry collection, Announcements from the Planetarium. Oh, Judith, I wanted to get to the book, the new book.
The book, yes. Yes.
That's the focus of
the reason we're doing this show.
Yeah.
Yes.
One of the reasons. But Announcements from the Planetarium, it's the title also of one of the poems included in the book. Why did you choose this title for the entire work?
Well, a couple reasons. One is it's a cool title. You know, when you're choosing to name things. Of course, writers, we are always choosing titles. Once you do the thing, then you've got to name the thing. And I thought Announcements from the Planetarium was a great line, and it could work as a title. And also, it's not just a title of a poem. It's a title from one of the, there's a couple series in the book, and one of the series is a series of what I call mixtapes. I think of myself as the DJ for these poems as opposed to the poet slash writer in the usual sense. And I liked the idea of using one of these weird little pieces, a mixtape, and calling attention to it by having it be the title poem. Also, the announcement that poem is making is relevant to at least one of the few, I say there's a few major themes that run through the poems in this collection. The rationale for putting them together was that they had these relationships, and one of them is reflected in this poem, Announcements from the Planetarium.
Would you like to read that?
Sure, I will read that. Astronomers can see the glow, infrared radiation from dust warmed by all the stars burning since everything ever. For right now, though, just give me one thing I can hold on to believe in this living is a hard way to go. Oh, you should keep on, no matter how difficult, unless it kills you. Then you know you've gone too far. And what I do with each of the mixtapes at the end of the poem is in italics a list that says, including words from, and in this case there are three people, Kim A. McDonald, a scientist, John Prine, and Alice Neal, the artist.
Oh, and I also wanted to mention at the reading, you started off your part of it. You had your publisher speak too, which was fantastic.
Yeah.
And you started off with two poems that you read, but they weren't your own poems. They were by other writers.
but they were both about childhood and youth, which I found very fitting, since the book, I think, is a meditation on memory, wisdom, mortality, takes us from youth to old age.
Yes.
So, and some autobiographical material in there, too. There's one piece in the book, maybe more prose than poem, which is somewhat of a brief synopsis of your life, and I wondered if you could read that for us. It's called After a Long Life, the short version.
I'd love to read it, but I have to admit, and I don't know if I said this at the reading last night or not, it really isn't my life. It's rooted in my life. It's rooted in my life in the sense that everything I write is rooted in my life, but I made up a lot of this stuff.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
Well, because we don't know each other that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, well,
it's a reader's kind of false assumption about authors in
well,
general.
Well, especially poetry, I think.
Yes.
People believe that poetry is never fiction, but I believe that everything that we write is fiction in the sense that you can't make your life into art. You can use your life when you make art with words or with marble or with paint or with dance or whatever, but it's not your life. And the farther away you get, the more it is what I'm calling fiction. This one's pretty far. Okay, do you still want me to read it?
Oh, yeah, please.
Okay. After a long life, the short version. Let me tell you about my childhood. How it was spent reading Shakespeare as soon as I could slide a chubby finger across the page of a faux folio, smudging the cheap ink. Then I'll tell you about my adolescence, the time I refused to speak for 19 days, and a counselor told my mother's new husband I should be sent away with Rosencrantz and Guildenstern, or maybe it was Rosenberg and Greenglass. Then I'll tell you about my years on the stage, my time as a traveling player, those hot months of summer stock in the southern states, where the only respite, rare and thrilling, was exiting the striped tent in the mowed field to sudden rain with hail the size of olives, cherries, plum tomatoes. Later, I can talk about the marriages, the children, the group therapy, the 12-step meetings, and my days in the Safeway parking lot, collecting carts because I needed a job that didn't require thinking. The pirate ship, the paper bag factory in Copenhagen, the loading dock in East Timor, each promised but did not deliver a do-not-think situation. Finally, wandering the North American West, crossing and recrossing rivers too fast and cold to soothe me, I won a door prize at a Friday night square dance at the Elks Hall in Boise. 10 days, free, at a health club. Well, I wanted health, so I went. Now all I want is the hot tub. Want only to be submerged, to walk naked down white tile steps into nearly boiling water, to sit on the underwater ledge while fierce streams push hard against my spine. I don't care about the free weights, though I'm glad they've been liberated. I don't want to spin, except maybe straw into gold. I won't use the track, the tennis court, the machines. I want only that ritual bath, the cool shiver after, the shiny hair dryers, the little bowl of Q-tips next to the stack of towels, the mirrored wall that tells me who I am.
Oh, thank you. I still love it, even though it.
I'm glad.
I realize now it's not
I'm glad.
Autobiographical.
Yeah. Yeah. When you get all those details, you think, no, wait a minute. She couldn't have done all that. Nobody's done all that. Although, I tell you, there are a few things here. Like, for instance, it is the dream of my life to have a money job that requires no thinking because I think too much. I think way too much. And I just want to have headspace, literally space, open space in my head, but I can't get it. I just can't get it. Anyway, that's an example of how it came from my life, but I just made up all this other stuff, which I love too.
Right.
I'm glad you agree.
Now, aside from the autobiographical details or the lack of them,
right.
The fiction, I described the book as a meditation on memory, wisdom, and mortality. There's one poem in the book that treats wisdom as almost a consolation prize for growing old. And it's called A Different Thing. I wonder if you could read that for us.
Yes, yes. Oh, I like the way you talk about it. I appreciate very much the way you're thinking about this stuff, because it's what I want from my readers. You know, very well, we don't always get from our audiences what we have in mind, but what we get is something we need to think about.
Or sometimes you don't know what you're getting.
Oh, for sure. Well, in radio, we don't know what they're thinking home. Out there.
Yeah, and if you're on late at night, you know, even 10 o'clock, you don't really know who's listening.
Exactly.
And I know there are people out there.
They're out there. We know they're out there. Yeah. And thank you for it, folks. Okay, this poem is called A Different Thing. I'm not saying I'm done collecting knowledge. I won't stop picking up shiny bits of information. I'm saying wisdom is a different thing. It's not about collection, accumulation. Maybe it's like sorting, arranging, mixing, and then steeping. It's like making tea, letting it steep, letting it sit a while, sometimes tasting it, learning what it is after you wait through the time it's been steeping. Fact is, everybody's wise sometimes, babies even, high school sophomores, 37-year-old bank managers. But as the main thing, the main way of the mind, the way that comes later, wisdom is, or means, something else. Something babies, high school sophomores, and 37-year-old bank managers don't do, have, or use. You can be old and not be wise, but you can't be wise if you're not this old. Not this much, this long, this often, not as a habit. The gift comes late, perhaps as compensation.
Which leads to my more obvious question, probably. As you grow older, do you see yourself growing wiser?
I actually, and this poem came out of that. For a while, I thought it was presumptuous to assume that I was becoming wise, as opposed to just accumulating information, because it keeps coming at you. You stay alive, it just keeps coming.
It comes in, it goes out.
Yes, exactly. So I feared being presumptuous, did not want to indulge in what I thought might be vain. But once I was past 70, I thought, you know, you really are thinking differently. You're doing, this is me talking to myself, you're doing different things with the collected information. If you're paying attention, I've come to think, feel, consider, you can almost not avoid it, really. You have all of this experience. You not only know stuff, but you've known how to put it together and work with it and make it into other stuff. And that's a kind of raw description of wisdom. But yeah, I'm now letting myself think that about myself.
We earlier talked about the mixtapes in the book, and you did this last night too, but you said the same thing here. You saw yourself more as a DJ here in gathering this material and putting it together rather than a poet.
Uh-huh.
And there's a number of references to musicians and songwriters in the book. Paul Simon, John Prine, Bob Dylan, the Beatles. In fact, the epigraph for the book is from a John Fogerty song.
Yes.
Rock and Roll Girls.
Uh-huh.
And it's "Sometimes I Think Life Is Just a Rodeo. The trick is to ride and make it to the bell." So I was wondering, do you find that choosing and arranging the poems in a collection like this is kind of like a songwriter choosing songs and arrangements for an album?
For an album? Oh, I'm sure. I don't know that I've thought of that particular analogy, but the minute you say it, I think, well, gotta be. The process of putting the stuff together has become, and this is true with prose as well, chapters even, has become one of the cool things I love about being a writer. It's not just a task assigned, now you have to put them together. The whole idea of making a book, like making an album, is creating a new thing. I'm taking these pieces. It's like quilting. Here's a piece that was part of an apron. Here's a piece that was part of my husband's work shirt. Here's a piece, you know, all of this. And I'm going to put them together, and I'm going to make something else that is not the work shirt, not the apron, Not at all. It's this new thing made of these pieces, which, as a matter of fact, I also made. And that's not necessarily true of DJs, but it is definitely true of musicians who are creating an album, which is why I like that analogy. They make the individual songs, like I make the individual sections or poems or chapters, and then they figure out how to put it together. And of course, I mean, right now, people are, what, celebrating some big anniversary of Beatles.
Oh, Sgt. Pepper's.
Of Sgt.
Yeah,
Pepper.
Out in 1967.
Yes. Okay, right. Yes,
years.
There we go. Yeah. 50 years. And I remember very well, Sgt. Pepper was a phenom, you know. What a phenomenon. It was a story. It was, you know, yes. They were all together.
Considered the first concept album.
Exactly.
Though I guess that's arguable among
right,
music,
for sure. And people are arguing about it as we speak.
Right.
All over the world. Nevertheless, it was notable. And it serves exactly what you're talking about, I think. I mean, serves as an example of what you're talking about. Those guys, they wrote a lot of songs. Some of them I'm sure we've never heard and never will, because not even geniuses make greatness all the time. Read some Dylan lyrics and give yourself some evidence for that.
There's a lot of work, I think, that goes into those songs. We tend to think that they just come easily to the
great
musicians
no way.
And songwriters.
No way. It's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. Each piece. And then this thing you're talking about and you're asking me about, the putting them together to create an album or a collection, in this case, a book, a chapbook, it's a whole nother job. And it's a great job. This is not a complaint. I love it. But it took me some years to realize, whoa, this is very much like the actual writing process. Mm-hmm. This is also using my creative spirit and my intellect in a way that I wouldn't if I were, like, I don't know, washing the dishes or something.
Oh, Judith, one last request. One of my favorite poems in the book is towards the end, so it might be a good way to go out. This one is called "You Never Think It's Not What You Want."
Oh, I wrote this poem, actually, this was a command performance from the cartoonist Nicole Hollander,
oh, yes.
Who created Sylvia and other bits of genius. And Nicole at the time was doing a blog and she was doing stuff about holidays. This was a few years ago. And she said, "I need a poem." I said, "Well, you know, what do you mean?" She said, "I need a poem, like soon." I said, "Well, how soon?" She said, "End of the week." This was like a Tuesday. I said, "You know, we don't usually do it that way." She said, come on. So, and that's why it says here, "For Nicole," at the end of the poem. Uh-huh. Anyway, all right. So, yes, I'm happy to read this. "You never think it's not what you want. We know it's wise to chew our food slowly, though long ago in the wild, and also now at the drive-through, this hasn't always been possible. So much that's wise seems so often not possible. Long ago and far away, early in the species, chewing slowly was a luxury or something for herbivores, the cud groups, not our zippy primate team of cousins. Chewing slowly could be dangerous. On holidays, though, a slow chew might save you from predators across the table, long-toothed in-laws, former lovers, crazy neighbors, your own grown children, the typical assortment in December. That month of longest night and shortest light has way too many holidays. Food is featured every time, served at tables, handed round on small trays, displayed for grazing guests who say yes, yes. December food is like toys, like gift wrap, like decoration, admired for its design, shining in the glitter of sparkling lights that dramatize the clever art of its frosting, its stuffing or shape, unnatural. So well prepared is all that food, so generously portioned and carefully contrived for delight, you never think it's not what you want, won't be what you can use, won't be what you need after the ball. When the party's over, the new year rung in, you really did get there with bells on. Your calendar looks just like last year. The months named January and so on. The weeks, again, all start with Monday, Tuesday. You dared to hope for something. You had some expectations. You made plans. You even thought the earth was your model, turning toward the light. But you forgot it never stops. All of forever just keeps on turning.
Oh, I love that last line.
Oh, great.
Comforting great. And frightening at the same time.
Yes, at the same time, because everything is so complicated.
You're listening to Jonesy on KBOO Portland, your community radio station. On today's show, we're celebrating the life of Judith Arcana, poet, writer, radio host, teacher, and activist, who died in December at the age of 82. We just heard Judith discussing her poetry collection Announcements from the Planetarium in July 2017. Next, we move from her poetry to her prose, focusing on Judith's book, Grace Paley's Life Stories, A Literary Biography, which began her long friendship with Grace. This is from our radio conversation in October 2018.
Judith, it's clear from the intro you have a very long, productive career as writer, teacher, activist. I'd like to focus on one of your books that combines all those roles. It's called Grace Paley's Life Stories, A Literary Biography. In a previous KBOO interview, we talked briefly about that book. You mentioned it got its start shortly after you entered grad school in 1984. You said you decided to write a biography, specifically about a woman you admire and could learn from. Why Grace Paley?
Well, I had read all of her stories up to that point. I read pretty much everything that was out up to, that she had done up to that point. And I loved the voice on the page, which was the voice in my head, even though I'd never actually heard her real voice at that time. I saw the mastery of the skill of writing. This was clearly an astonishingly skilled writer. And also a lot of her ideas and attitudes, and some of her background were things that had a lot of personal appeal for me. I sometimes still say is, even though she's dead now. She was about 20 years older than me. So she was a generation up, and I thought, okay, there's a lot of learning here. And so she was at the top of my short list, I like to say.
And she died in 2007,
yes,
you mentioned that.
August of 2007, yes.
Now, the book's a result of intensive research, your intensive research into Grace's work and life, and also several very long conversations you recorded with Grace over a period of time beginning in 1985 and some of her family members. How did you approach her about cooperating on the book with you?
I first met her in early November of 84. I went deliberately to this particular symposium near Chicago because I heard she was going to be there, and I thought, okay, I'll meet her, I'll listen to her, now I'll know. It'll be her in person, and she was quite wonderful. And so I got in line with all the other people who wanted to talk to her afterwards, and I told her I wanted to write about her. And I think I told you this before. I can't remember now, but she said, "Oh, that's nice, honey."
Take you too seriously.
She
at
did
that
not
time.
Take yeah. me seriously. But then I made deep eye contact and said, "I really mean it. I want to write a book about you. I am a writer." And then she got serious and she gave me her mailing address. And then I started to write to her. I sent her copies of my first two books so that she would know I was literate and that I could.
You're bona fides.
Right, that I was the real thing. And at first, she was really not going to do it. But I, and of course, I'll never know exactly what tipped it, but at some point she called me up and said, "All right, let's
you,
do
you told
it.
That great story about coming home and
finding the voice
on your answering machine. Isn't that just amazing?
It is incredible.
Yeah, my answering machine is mostly spam calls. I never get anything from Grace Paley.
Well, this was a while ago.
Yeah. Now, I mentioned you had several conversations with her, some very long ones.
Oh,
and,
yes.
She so graciously invited you into her home and life. What were those conversations like? What was it like talking with her?
Were you
put off a little at first, this great writer?
I was never put off because she was such a normal human.
Uh-huh.
She was so completely comfortable for me. Once she decided to do it and said, when I think I said this the last time we were talking on air, I said, do you have any ideas of where I might stay that's near where you live? And she said, what do you mean? You'll stay with me. And I thought, okay, this is really happening, you know? And so there I was in her apartment where she'd lived for many, 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 many years in the Village in New York. And over the time that I knew her, 20 plus a few, she also began to spend a lot of time in Vermont. So sometimes when I visited, I would be with her in Vermont. Once or maybe twice, she came to Chicago. She had a gig or something. And so we got to hang out on my turf as well in those days.
And she was very candid with you. So
completely.
It wasn't like she was giving you a story or anything.
No, no. I never felt that she was either evading or... It never entered my mind that she was prevaricating. And if she didn't want to talk about something, she would have told me. I knew that by the time I had been with her for several hours the first occasion. She was right out there. And also, we had interests in common. I wanted to know, how did you do this? Why did you do this? Who were you with? And we talked about the ending of her first marriage, and we talked about the raising of her children, completely intimate stuff and overtly political stuff, and she was game. And I had an old-style tape recorder on almost all the time, and that was completely fine with her.
I know there was one point in the book where you asked her, how does she get all of this done? You can't do everything. And she said, why can't you do everything?
Yes.
That's funny.
It was.
It seems that she did.
I thought, oh, well, okay, she may be a role model, but I'm probably not going to be able to, quote-unquote, do everything. But she did.
Now, the book is titled Grace Paley's Life Stories, a literary biography. What do you mean by a literary biography?
Well, I'll tell you what I mean. What I mean is that the original publisher wanted that as the subtitle. And it had never entered my mind to use that phrase. And I talked to Grace about it, and she wasn't any more thrilled with it than I was. But it was clear that there was really nothing wrong with it, and it wasn't a lie. It was just so academic and kind of heavy-handed, you know?
I thought it was descriptive, though. That's what I was trying to get at with the format of the book.
And then I realized, and actually talked with her about this, that it was accurate in the very sense that you're alluding to. After all, I was interested in her as a writer. And although I was also very interested in her as an activist, I was exceptionally interested in the way those two things came together, were together in her life. So that the book turns out to be a story of how her politics, her way of being in the world, and her extensive activism inform her work as a writer, as well as much else.
Well, one thing you do, I think, extremely successfully in the book is combine this story, this narrative of Grace's life and her writing and her activism, her different roles, her family roles, along with excerpts from her published work. How did you stumble on that or come up with that? Just a perfect format for her.
Well, thanks. I don't even know how to answer it in terms of, like, how did I? It just seems
it's not
like...
It's not common in biographies of writers to do that extensively.
I guess not. I have actually talked to other biographers over the years, and I'm not interested in writing any more biographies, so it's not like I'm studying it, but some really wonderful biography writers and I have had conversations, and so I know you're right. But it just seemed so natural, so appropriate. It's one thing for me to quote her. It's another thing for me to say something about her. And it's yet another thing, a thing of value, for me to quote what she has written, primarily fiction in this book, but also occasionally a line from a poem or an essay, so that my reader, I hope, can hear her voice on the page as well as my voice on the page.
Yeah, one interesting thing that you quote her in the book as saying she doesn't really see that big a line, if any at all, between fiction and nonfiction.
Right.
She mentioned a memoir that she said seemed very fictionalized.
Yeah.
And her work is fiction, but there's a lot of incidents from her life that she kind of plays on in the books.
Yes, In that particular set of remarks, she says this, to me, wonderful thing. She says fiction, nonfiction, and then she talks about how it's convenient for booksellers, it's convenient for librarians, they can make shelves with particular categories. But then she says, but it's story. It's all story.
And that's what Grace was about as a writer, was telling stories, making up stories, using as her raw material, real life, of course. Talk about a person embedded in the life of her time. That would be Grace. And then going beyond that into making art out of the real stuff.
And she happened to have a character. You mentioned that this character recurs in at least 13 of the 45 collected stories, Faith Darwin Asbury,
yes,
which seems to be Grace's doppelganger. So your particular way of combining life and her fiction and her other writing work especially well with Grace Paley.
Well, I read the stories over and over while I was working on the book, which was not difficult because they're wonderful. And I saw, I believe, that was what was happening. That's my my theory presented in the book. And so it was there. It was there for the taking, speaking as
it's
a
very
scholar
well supported,
and writer.
the theory, because you go into her grandparents, her parents, her siblings, her kids,
yeah,
and you can find kind of reflections of those people in characters in the book.
I think so. At the same time, and for sure, if Grace were here, she would say this, they are not exactly who those people were.
I have my next question exactly about that.
Okay.
In the book's introduction, you ask Grace if her stories are autobiographical.
Uh-huh.
And she replies, no, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that I wrote my life into the stories. Don't you see the difference? So, Judith, what do you see as the difference?
Well, what I see is this method, this process, that the raw material is the life and is literally inside of her, the mind, the spirit, the writing hand, because she certainly, I found I will use the term manuscript, stuff written in pencil on little scraps of paper in her office, and she was writing out of, she was, as we all are, a container of all that her life had put in, and she, by choice, was taking it out and using it as if it were the ingredients of a recipe that she was concocting to make something else out of it.
You had one line I really liked in the book, among others.
It wasn't more, just than one.
More, more than one. You wrote, writing biography, I thought about what it means to make up our lives, to invent ourselves through the years. So it seems that was a little bit of what Grace Paley was up to in her fiction.
I think so. And I also really do think that. I was just writing something like this in the last several days because I'm working on a preface for the new edition. And I guess I got to say, I believe that. That's what we are doing. Raw material comes in, sometimes comes at us, and we take it in and we make up our lives out of all of that stuff.
You're listening to Jonesy on KBOO Portland, your community radio station. We just heard Judith Arcana talking about her book, Grace Paley's Life Stories, a literary biography, and her friendship with Grace. Next, we move from Judith's poetry and prose to a book that combines her activism for reproductive justice with her writing. The story collection, Hello, This is Jane. From our KBOO Between the Covers interview in July 2020. Judith, in the intro, we mentioned your work as a Jane in Chicago in the years just before the Supreme Court ruled on Roe v. Wade. So that was January 1973. It's such an important part of Hello, This is Jane. Could you give us a little background on the Janes, which was officially called, and this is a long name, the Abortion Counseling Service of the Chicago Women's Liberation Union, or just the service for short?
Well, of course, I'll give you the briefest of briefs. In the mid to late 60s, a particular woman, Heather Booth, one of the people whose name is already known, had occasion to help a friend find a local, which is to say in Chicago, abortionist for his sister, who was in a terrible shape and needed abortion health care. And she did that. And then, of course, as such things do happen, people heard that Heather knew how to find somebody. And then other people started calling her, asking her for information. And she finally had a meeting of women from the union that you just named in that long
Yes, the service.
The service. Well, what became the service.
Uh-huh.
And she said to the other women, look, this is clearly something that needs to be done. And they said, absolutely. And they started up first as a referral service, then over time started learning medical procedures themselves. And by the time the service was over, it had become completely independent of asking other folks for their services and was able, therefore, to lower the price to $100 or whatever you could afford. I remember very clearly one woman that I was the counselor for who had $9. And I thought over the years, what would have become of her if she had tried to go to a regular doctor, even one who was willing to do abortions when they were illegal? They charged $1,000 or more. So yeah, that's a very brief capsule version.
Oh, of course, we'll get more into it as we go along. I want to go back to that 1968 when the Janes were starting. You were teaching high school in Chicago, and it was at the very same school you attended as a student. And you loved
it. Actually, a little north of Chicago. I have to, I was in a township north of Chicago, not in the city.
Oh, okay. And you loved your job.
I certainly did.
But you were fired, I think, primarily for political reasons. But yes. Since you had tenure as a high school teacher and presumably the support of the union, what was the case for termination and what were those real reasons?
Well, it turns out, or in those days, I don't know if the laws are the same in Illinois, but at that time, the law was that if a tenured teacher was fired, that teacher had the right to a public hearing. And three of us were fired, two of whom were tenured. So the other tenured teacher and I insisted on our public hearing, which turned out to, we thought it would be an hour or two. It took months, when a period of months from May of 1970 down to October of 1970, two or three nights a week in the high school auditorium, sitting. Hundreds of people came to the auditorium, most of them students and students' parents, and the school board listened to what was essentially a court case. They had a lawyer, we had a lawyer, we called witnesses, they called witnesses, and you will not be shocked to learn that at the end of this entire quote-unquote hearing, which was obviously a trial, the school board, which had the power under the law to be the judges, decided that they had been right to fire us. And so that was that. That was the end. I was a high school teacher for 6 years, loving it all the while.
And then again, to set the scene, so you were fired from a job that you loved. We should also mention this is happening in the context of Chicago in the late 60s and the entire nation, for that matter, with the protests against the Vietnam War, the election of Richard Nixon as president, the police murders of Black Panthers, Fred Hampton, Matt Clark. So that must have been a galvanizing moment for you personally and politically.
Definitely so. I always say that is an example of how often it is that the teacher is learning just as much as, if not more than, the students in a teacher-student relationship. They came into the classroom. I'm not saying everybody did this, but great numbers of them responding to the very circumstances that you just named one after another came into the classroom and said, can we read this? Let's talk about this. How about this? And I thought, you know, it took me a while to get with the program, so to speak, even though the school board thought I and my colleagues, we were the instigators, because they had no respect, really, for the minds of those young people. It never occurred to them that those young people were thinking what they were thinking on their own, based on what was happening in the country and the world, as you just gave in that list. So they blamed it on the grown-ups, so to speak, which is so often the case. Teachers are being fired all over the country. And my knowledge base was growing exponentially. My consciousness was rising like a thermometer in a fever. And it was the beginning for me of serious and what became deeply rooted political consciousness, those years and the being fired. And then, of course, joining an underground abortion service,
right,
that too ramped up my consciousness considerably.
That's what I was leading up to. But first, I'm thinking nationwide protests, terrible president in the White House, police murdering African Americans. That was
Sounds familiar, right? Yes,
unfortunately, way too familiar. Now, when you joined the Janes, abortion was illegal in most of the U.S., with a few exceptions. New York, it was legalized in 1970. I just read that in Oregon, it actually became legal in 1969. So it's really difficult for younger people today to imagine what it was like for a woman wanting an abortion at that time. But it was mostly done undercover, not always under the safest, most sanitary conditions. And as you mentioned before, it could be very expensive, $1,000, which was a whole lot more in 1970. What was the what was the situation like in Chicago?
Well, pretty much what you've described. I mean, Illinois was not one of the handful of states that had abortion as a legal healthcare procedure. And so both actual degreed medical practitioners, docs, could do abortions undercover, underground. They often charged a lot of money. Not very many of them did it, of course. And also people who did not have the best interests of the women who came to them at heart or in their minds, who also charged a lot of money and didn't necessarily do a good job. So that was pretty common in Illinois, certainly in the Chicago area. It was common everywhere. And as you noted, Ken, there were a few places women with money could travel to New York or to England or to Japan or to Puerto Rico, some places that folks with money could go in those days where abortion was legal. But how many people is that? You know, it's always true for the rich. They can do whatever they want because they can buy it.
Right. Now, as a Jane, Judith, you went from putting women in touch with doctors, so mainly a counseling service, to actually performing the abortions. And I've heard you talk about that story, how one of the doctors the Janes recruited to do the abortions, the Janes found out he wasn't really a medical doctor, but he was still able to do it. But that gave you, as a group, the inspiration to say, well, why can't we do it? So how did you go about doing that? What was your training to do some of these medical procedures?
Well, first of all, he was, this particular guy who wasn't really a doctor was absolutely the best. He was very, very good. And he treated the women in goodly ways. And he was approving of what we were doing and friendly to the enterprise, shall we say. And some of us became friends with him. I was not one of those people, although I was sort of an adjunct buddy. Sometimes on non-work days, some of us would hang out, and that's how I got to know him, as well as when we finally leaned on him enough to start teaching us stuff. At first he said, no. And we just kept it up. And because he was, as I say, you know, basically decent and totally connected ultimately with us. Plus we were a tremendous source of income for him, you know. He didn't even have to do what he used to do in the old days. We just said, come on, we've hundreds of women are calling us every week. We'll book this, you know. Anyway, he came over to that notion of, well, if he can do it, we can do it. And he taught a couple of us, and those people taught others of us. And he did a little teaching as well. And then pretty soon, he happily was phased out. The mob was after him. The cops were after him. He moved out of state. And by then, he had trained enough of us, and those people had trained enough of us, so that we knew how to perform what in those days was the typical abortion, which was a DNC, dilatation and curettage. And for what we called long terms, people farther along in the pregnancy, procuring a miscarriage, which then would have to take place separately. But anyway, we learned how to do it just as he had learned how to do it underground, but from someone who really, really knew what to do.
Now, you and several other Janes were labeled the Abortion Seven, I guess because Chicago Seven was already taken. When you were arrested in Chicago, May 3rd, 1972 is the date. So it was just 8 months or so before Roe v. Wade. Can you tell us about the arrest and the charges? And the arrest is actually fictionalized in several of the stories in the new collection. And I got to say, I saw your mugshot, which is on the cover of one of the the zines, yes. The chapbooks, and you look so badass.
Do I really? Oh, wow. I never thought of it that way. The publisher of that zine, that was his idea. He said, we're going to put the mugshot on the cover. I said, are you serious? I mean, I thought, really? What's that about? Well, turns out he absolutely knew what he was doing. People are totally into that mugshot, fine with me. And the reason that I have it is that one of the things we did after Roe was decided in January, at the end of January of 73, was that we wanted all of our records because we were no longer criminals once Roe was decided. And so I have the paperwork and I have the mugshot and, you know, and the other six do too. Anyway, so there were seven of us working that day, hence the title, The Abortion Seven. And, you know, it's scary to be arrested. We always knew that it could happen sometime. We didn't think about it much. We were pretty busy and we certainly knew it was illegal, but you know, law is not the same thing as justice. They are two different things. And not just in this country, but everywhere in the world, many things that are the law are completely unjust. For openers, this country is, you know, as an economic entity, it was, of course, completely based on enslavement, the enslavement of people. That was the law. So law in and of itself was not a concern. Behaving in goodly ways, being of use, those were the concerns. So have I answered that question? Or should I go?
Oh, no, you did. I just wanted to add that as a result of the arrest, you were actually indicted by a grand jury, or the Abortion Seven, so all the Janes who were arrested. And again, the difference between law and justice. The law said the charges were felony homicide.
Exactly.
And conspiracy to commit abortion, because it was illegal at the time, which meant, you know, homicide, conspiracy, that could have meant years in jail for you. But yeah. In January 1973, so a few months later, the Supreme Court came down with the Roe v. Wade decision. Yeah. So for several reasons, then you must have been extremely relieved and overjoyed.
And we all were enormously relieved, of course. And for me personally, one of the reasons was that I had a little baby on purpose at that time. And so my first thought, literally, even on the day of the bust, was, they're going to take my baby away from me because they're, you know, they're these charges. So that was pretty grim.
The book is based, of course, on your experience as a Jane, and you've written some email letters to help promote the book during the quarantine, during the pandemic. You say that you didn't start bringing this experience into your own work, at least consciously and deliberately, until 1998. And I was wondering, what was the spark?
You know, that's a really good question. And unfortunately, I don't have a really good answer. But the answer that I have is I remember the moment. I don't know what made the moment happen. But it's just so classic in terms of symbolism, maybe metaphor. I don't know. But anyway, here's what it was. I was in the kitchen of my home, and I was breaking eggs into a bowl. And all of a sudden, I had this, it's sort of, you know, it sounds kind of creepy, but it was totally positive. I had this bodily sensation, and I dropped the egg thing, wiped my hands on the dish towel, grabbed the closest pen and paper. I always see to it wherever I live, pens and pencils and paper everywhere. Even now, when we all live online, I do that as well as the computer, and started writing and created what became the first poem that would be in the book, What If Your Mother, which came out in 2005, which is poems and monologues that are rooted in my learning in those years. And that poem begins with eggs. And the idea, you know, yeah, chickens make a man, so do we. And what is that? What does that mean? And the experience of breaking the eggs deliberately. So that's the beginning. Why that happened at that time on that day, haven't got a clue. But as you just heard, I remember the moment.
Of course, yeah. That answers the question, which came first, the chicken or the egg?
Yes.
In this case, it was the egg.
Absolutely.
Now, we mentioned Grace Paley, who was also a friend of yours and a mentor and a subject of that wonderful literary biography, Grace Paley's Life
Thank
Stories.
You for the good words about the book. Yeah.
And the epigraph for Hello, This Is Jane comes from Grace.
Yes.
It goes, quote, fiction, nonfiction, they're made up categories, helpful for librarians and bookstores, but it's all story, really. It's all story. And in one of the stories in the book, soon to be a major motion picture, which we talked about, you write, quote, this is what Grace Paley meant when she said a story is a lie the writer tells in order to tell the truth. Which brings me to the question, why did you write about your Jane experience initially as poems, you know, that egg incident in 1998, then as fiction rather than as nonfiction or a memoir?
I remember 10 years after the Roe decision, I did an op-ed for one of the Chicago newspapers. Please don't ask me which one. But anyway, and after that, I wrote essays, and there are essays of mine online and in, you know, newspapers or whatever over the years. So I did write nonfiction prose, either about the service or based on what I learned in the service, here and there, now and then. But the poems just came on, just this heavy vibe, like from, you know, starting with that moment in the kitchen. And then the stories, I think, happened not quite so dramatically, but in similar ways, in that characters came into my head. I didn't want to take, you know, sort of like being a vampire, I guess, to steal someone else's life story. I know that some writers don't mind doing that, but I'm not so much into it. So I preferred the idea of knowing what, in fact, there is a book that is nonfiction based on interviews, and there is a play based on interviews. Both of them have been around for years now and doing good work in the world about the abortion service. And I wanted to not have to do, as I did in my first three books, when I interviewed lots and lots of people, to have to be true to someone else. I wanted to just make it up because I already had all this information. And what I did was, I never again, until literally this year, looked at that nonfiction book or the text of that play. It's been decades, you know, it's been a couple of decades at least since I looked at those because I wanted to just spin it out. And that's what I did.
Yes, I want to go into two stories. One we already mentioned, soon to be major motion picture, to give examples from the book itself. And that was originally published as a chapbook, and it's told by a fictional character, one of the Janes named Dina Marcus, who seems somewhat of an alter ego for the author. And Dean is telling the story from a future time when, as you write, quote, everybody finally recognized that Roe was now irrelevant, eviscerated. So there's a speculative aspect to the story. Fortunately, still speculative. We don't know what's going to be happening. And Dina is talking to some movie producers about pitching the bust of the Janes, brainstorming it as a movie. What appealed to you about recounting that event as fiction? Were those fictional elements of making it into a movie at a time when abortion was no longer easily or legally available?
Well, I actually, in your question, you have the answer. I wanted people to know that this could be done, that it was done, and that, yes, we got arrested, and you need to know about that. There's no pretense here that it's all happy-go-lucky, but this is a story that is useful to people who want to take action now. And of course, as we speak right now, there are people who are doing abortions in the parts of the many, many parts of the United States in the year 2020, where abortion is, if not straight up illegal, almost impossible or literally impossible to find. And so I like the idea of on the big screen or even on some of the smaller screens now, having movies about the service in general, and then specifically about the bust, hence that story, so that folks can think about that in detail, so to speak, you know?
Yeah, it brings up, and this is something I didn't know, and I've read a lot of your work and talked to you a lot. You actually helped with an indie movie. It was a feature, so it was fictional, called Ask a Jane. I think Ask for Jane. It came out about 2 years ago. You were considered a consulting producer on it, but you also had a small part.
Well, it's so small. I mean, most people say, yeah, if you blink, you'll miss me. But in this case, that's actually true.
I actually watched I haven't seen the movie, but I watched the trailer through the website IMDb. And you're in that trailer. So
I am in the trailer.
It was a real surprise, but there's a case where the same event, the Abortion 7, the arrest was fictionalized in this movie. I didn't do enough research to tell listeners and readers where to find out more about the movie, but I guess they can Google that just as easily as I can.
I was just going to say, they have a website. Just go on, take a look at one of your search engines, type in Ask for Jane movie, and you will find lots of stuff that will tell you how you can get it or where you can see it, et cetera. Yeah.
So there's a case where this fictional story actually became somewhat of a reality, I guess, a few years after you wrote it.
Absolutely. And I enjoyed working with those people very much. It was one of those things that I care a lot about in this time anyway. I mean, these happen to be very congenial, actually excellent humans. But even if we hadn't clicked in that way, I love the idea of people who are generations younger than me, who care about this stuff, wanting to talk to the elders who were there then, and what they have to teach me and what I have that's maybe of use to them. It's a grand exchange. I love doing
it. Which is actually a nice, smooth transition to my next question, which is about a story that is about exactly that. It's called Keisha and Joni and Jane. It was originally published as a zine. It takes place, again, in Portland, Oregon, but in a kind of fictional Portland, Oregon in the near future. Abortion is illegal here in the story.
In the story.
And the story's written in the form of a group meeting between several of the original Janes, so the older women from the 1970s in Chicago, and a group of women in Portland, somewhat contemporary or near future Portland, who are the new Janes. And it gives you a chance to make the new Janes much more diverse in terms of ethnic, cultural background, and sexual orientation. So I was wondering, was that done on purpose so you could kind of reimagine Janes from your day to what they would be like as your contemporaries today?
I didn't think of it I like that line about the reimagining. I can't take credit for actually having thought of that, but I definitely was along those lines in my own imaginings. I live in the present, even though the story is futured, that of course any group, and of course it's happening right now while we're talking, or folks, while you're listening to this broadcast, people of various colors and sizes and sexual identities and genderedness, et cetera, are going to be the ones who are making stuff happen. Now, we were a pale lot until the very end in the last 6 or 8 months, I think, of the service's existence. There was one African-American woman and one Latina who did some time as Janes. So, yeah, great differences in that regard. And there was not one out lesbian. I mean, it's so ridiculous when you think about it now. It's like crazy. How could that have been? But really, as a lot of my characters say, it was different then. And I don't think that the lesbianic Janes were afraid that the other Janes would shun them or anything. It was what you did in those days. People were not out until, as I like to think, 10 minutes later, when suddenly, boom, Stonewall, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, now, unfortunately, it's back to being dangerous. There's been several cases, even in Portland, of gay couples. Never really stopped, right.
But great strides have been made. That striding is not going to stop.
Well, that's all for this episode of Jonesy here on KABU Community Radio.
If you missed any part of the show, we'd just like to hear it all again. You could stream this episode and previous episodes online at kboo.fm/program/Jonesy, J-O-N-E-S-Y, or just search for it on the KBOO website. On today's show, we've been celebrating the life of Judith Arcana, poet, writer, radio host, teacher, and activist, who died in December at the age of 82. You just heard a sampling of my radio conversations with Judith over the years, touching on her poetry, her nonfiction, and her activism, especially her time as a Jane in pre-Roe v. Wade Chicago. Judith was a good friend and much loved by everyone who worked with her at KBOO, and we miss her. You can learn more about her work and her life at juditharcana.com. Jonesy, by the way, comes to you every other week on the second and fourth Thursdays of the month from 10:30 to 11:30 a.m. Tune in for our next show on Thursday, February 26, 2026. I'm your host, Ken Jones, no relation, saying,
when the party's over, the new year rung in, you really did get there with bells on. Your calendar looks just like last year. The months named January and so on. The weeks, again, all start with Monday, Tuesday. You dared to hope for something. You had some expectations. You made plans. You even thought the earth was your model, turning toward the light. But you forgot it never stops. All of forever just keeps on turning.